This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Leanne Hansen.
And I'm Neil Conan. 10 years ago today, a peace accord signed in a hotel ballroom in Dayton, Ohio, brought an end to the long and bloody civil war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. In the years of fighting that followed the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, almost 300,000 Bosnians were killed and more than 1 million driven from their homes. The agreement divided the country along ethnic lines, a separate area for Serbs and a Muslim-Croat federation. While many acknowledge the agreement was less than perfect and often Byzantine, among other things, there are three presidents, it did stop the carnage. American and European troops entered the country to enforce the peace. Some remain to this day. A decade later, the peace still holds, but the situation remains fragile. Today on the program, we'll talk about what happened in Dayton 10 years ago and the challenges that lie ahead.
Later in the show, NPR Puzzle Master Will Shortz will join us, and we have an email challenge for you. If you have a puzzle for him, zap it along to us. The address is totn@npr.org. Again, if you have a puzzle for the Puzzle Master, email us at totn@npr.org.
But first, Dayton, 10 years on. If you have questions about what happened during the negotiations or about the lessons of Dayton, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is that same one, totn@npr.org. We'd especially like to hear from those of you who served in Bosnia. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is Laura Silber. She covered the Balkan Wars for the Financial Times in the 1990s and co-wrote a book called Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. She frequently returns to the region as a senior policy advisor at the Open Society Institute. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us, if you would, after so many years of civil war, what was it that brought these three parties to Dayton?
Well, I think it was a combination of A, exhaustion from fighting the war, and B, the consistent and constant pressure led by the United States and Europe that really forced the parties to the negotiating table.
Forced the parties? How?
Well, a combination of threats, of cajoling, of coaxing, and I think that's what it took to get them all, and finally, frankly, to sequester them in Dayton, where they couldn't go away, where they couldn't just go home, and it was pretty much that which really it took to get them really to concentrate and actually endorse a peace agreement.
Yeah, we talk about the signing ceremony at the hotel ballroom, but really it was 3 weeks on an Air Force base that provided this agreement.
That's right.
Now, you have an op-ed in today's New York Times in which you write, Dayton won the grudging endorsement of rival leaders by embodying contradiction, most significantly within the constitutional structure of the new state. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think in many ways, Dayton was all things to all people. For the Serbs, which at that time controlled the majority of the territory, it gave them a chance to have two separate entities, that they had what they proclaimed as the Srpska Republika, Republika Srpska, an independent, what they chose to see really as an independent part of a whole of Bosnia. Now, obviously, for the vast majority of the outside world, as well as for the Muslims and the Croats in Bosnia, they didn't want this. They didn't want Serbia to have an Bosnian Serbs to have an independent entity. And what they got, though, was a unified country and, at least in name at the time, a central government.
So what do you think, Laura, was Dayton's biggest achievement?
I think it was stopping the war. I think it was, actually, you look at it, there was not a single American killed by enemy fire in that intervention, in that whole years of the peacekeeping. And I think it was really in getting the people to start the long and slow process of living together, at least in the same state, and of, you know, starting about the business of rebuilding a state.
Before the war, Bosnia, and certainly the city of Sarajevo, its capital, was a multi-ethnic society. Is it today?
That's what I think is the biggest loss of the war, in addition, obviously, to the lost lives and the millions of people who were displaced by the war. It was the loss of the cosmopolitan nature of what was Sarajevo and Bosnia, the idea that it didn't matter whether someone was Serbian or Croat or Muslim. It was a mixed and common heritage of being Bosnian. And I think to a great extent, that is lost today. It still lives on in individuals, and it still lives on in Sarajevo, perhaps, but it's not the same strong sense of what Sarajevo was basically a Bosnia in miniature as well as a former Yugoslavia in miniature.
And today it is?
It's a city where you have people who are cosmopolitan. You have people who are obviously from mixed marriages or just identify themselves as Bosnian rather than as Serbs, Croats, or Muslims. But it's also a city that for 4 years was under a siege, a city where many people, no one's life was untouched by the war. And I think you have a residue of that and of a city that's not quite the proud centerpiece of Bosnia that it once was.
Laura, you've been back quite frequently. What's it like economically there today?
It's made, obviously, a vast improvement from the end of the war. So we have to be careful when we look at it. We have to also realize it takes a long time to rebuild from nothing. But today, many people who have the option of leaving Bosnia or Sarajevo will leave. People who can vote with their feet, so to say, people who can go, who have a better chance of building a life elsewhere, they will leave. You have a Bosnia where it's very, very complicated to rebuild an economy because of the very complicated construct of Dayton, the Dayton Agreement, the agreement that was done 10 years ago today. It's everything has to be negotiated. It's very complicated to do, say, any kind of simple economic reform, which may not even be so simple, becomes even more complicated in Bosnia-Herzegovina today.
If you have questions about what happened 10 years ago or about the future of Bosnia, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get a call in from Jacob. Jacob's calling us from Minneapolis.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is that why did not the NATO peacekeeper put enough effort to arrest Ratko Mladic and his master Radovan Karadzic for the war crimes they committed? I mean, they were in the area mm-hmm. at the time when they got in. And I am very pessimistic. If those guys stayed on the loose, that the peace would get unraveled if anything happened. And I'm afraid that the reason they did not do that because they don't want to antagonize the Serb population, who may think that they are their heroes,
war
criminals.
Mladic and Karadzic are the indicted war criminals. Laura Silber?
I think you raise a very important point. I think that the fact that 10 years later these two men are free and at liberty is actually a constant reminder and an impediment to rebuilding some sort of Bosnia. Because these men are free, because despite the fact that tens of thousands of international forces have been deployed there, they still have not been captured. I hope that these men are obviously captured within the next year, because it really we have a relatively short window of when there's still an international military presence there that might do that. And even perhaps if you have local armed forces ultimately making the arrest, it's very complicated, and the fact that it hasn't been done when there was such a huge presence, I think, is a huge problem. And obviously this is one of the major failings, I think, of the people that implemented the peace, the fact that they're not arrested yet.
Jacob, thanks very much for the call.
We turn now to someone who was directly involved with the negotiations at the Dayton Peace Conference. Carl Bildt is the former Prime Minister of Sweden, and he was the European Union co-chairman of the Dayton Peace Conference. He also served as the EU's first international high representative in Bosnia from 1996 to 1997. He joins us on the line from Stockholm, Sweden. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
What do you consider to be the breakthrough point at Dayton?
I think the breakthrough point was rather earlier. I think the key thing that was done was the agreement in early September, where the foreign ministers from Zagreb, from Sarajevo, and Belgrade were brought together, and there was an agreement on really the broad outlines of what then later became the Dayton Agreement. Dayton was then the details, difficult as they were, and there was a serious risk of the entire thing breaking down. But that was exactly where you had the so-called inter-ethnicity boundary line. It was a lot of the implementation issues. It was, to a certain extent, the constitutional issues. The breakthrough in political terms, of course, was when, from my European perspective, when Washington decided to get serious. Prior to that, there hadn't been that serious engagement from Washington on the political side. But late summer, there was a change of emphasis in Washington, and it was possible to get very quickly then agreement between the Europeans and the Americans on what needed to be done. And then, from then on, we had a peace process worthy of the name, which we hadn't had, I would say, for 3 years. We prolonged the war for a long time. But when we got serious, we were able to close down the war within a couple of months.
What was it like on that Air Force base for those 3 weeks? Were people talking to each other like in the hallways, or was it always formal negotiations?
No, I mean, I would say it was more talking in the hallways than it was formal negotiations. I mean, for a long time, I remember the first week, we spent doing virtually nothing, just hovering around, and there were talks on rather sort of marginal issues, but it was very difficult to get to the grips on the core issues. I mean, the atmosphere was fairly relaxed. Everyone was talking to everyone. But there were also serious disagreements within the different delegations. I mean, it's easy to see it as sort of the Muslims versus the Serbs, for example, but there were very serious disagreements within the Bosnian Muslim delegation that created a lot of problems. And there were on the Serb side, there was Milosevic, who was fairly easy to deal with because he wanted an agreement. And then there was the Bosnian Serbs, who were kept in the dark to a very large extent by Milosevic. And then there was President Tudjman, who was primarily interested in settling the problems of Eastern Slavonia in Croatia. So it was very much up and down. It was a strange experience, those 3 weeks.
Stay with us, if you would, Carl Bildt, and also Laura Silber. We're talking today about Dayton Accords, which were signed 10 years ago today. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke will join us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan.
And I'm Leanne Hansen. 10 years ago, the signing of the Dayton Peace Accords ended a bloody war in what was then Yugoslavia. Today, we're talking about what's happened in Bosnia since the end of that war. Our guests are Laura Silber, author of Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation, and who covered the war for the Financial Times, and Carl Bildt, former Prime Minister of Sweden and European Union co-chairman of the Dayton Peace Conference. You're also invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And our email address is totn@npr.org.
And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Bill. Bill's calling us from Chapel Hill in North Carolina.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
My question is the way you have spoken of the people dividing themselves. And by that, I mean you speak of Serbs from Serbia, I assume, Croats, same, Croatia, and Muslims. And that's my question is, two names are place names. I'm from here or there. It could be any religion in the world, but I'm from one of these two places. The third one is a religion, the most of whom, most people who are Muslim, are from Indonesia. So why not, like, people identifying themselves as Christians, Jews, and Muslims, or Buddhists, or Serbians and Croats and Romanians, or doesn't matter, Chinese?
Mm-hmm. Carl Bildt, how did those self-identifications enter into this? How did those self-identifications enter into this?
It's a long history, but I think it's a very valid point, and this goes to the crux of what Bosnia is. You can say that what divides these people is not that they are ethnically different. They are all Slavs, no different, virtually the same language. But they are divided through history by three different religions, three different cultural traditions. They are Christian Orthodox, they are Muslim, Ottomans I would call them, and they are Catholics. And the Catholics happen to be Croats, and the Orthodox happens to be Serb, in general terms. And historically speaking, there was a rise during the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s in Bosnia of an attempt to get the Muslims recognized as Muslims. I mean, that was President Izetbegovic's big thing throughout his political career, that he wanted to have the Muslim nationality recognized as such. And that's why we ended up with this, I agree with that, not entirely correct way of saying Croats, Muslims, and Serbs. We could also say Catholics, Muslim, and Orthodox, or we could say Bosnians about them all.
Bill, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Prime Minister Bildt, after 10 years, do you regard Dayton as a success, and what do you think needs to be done now?
Well, I think Dayton was distinctly a success in closing down the war and undertaking quite a number of measures in terms of state building that has made it virtually certain that the war is not going to come back in Bosnia. I'm fairly confident about that. Then state building is a long-term process, and I think there was a tendency in Dayton, immediately after Dayton, to think that this was a fairly quick, easy thing. It's not. It's a long-term, very demanding thing to build a state where we have, as we just discussed, really three different nationalities of three different cultural and political traditions that needs to be coming together. So Dayton was a success in ending the war. Whether Bosnia has been a success since then is more debatable. I'm very worried by the economic and social situation in the country. I think the politicians of Bosnia have been failing in the last few years in coming to grips with the real long-term issues that are facing them. I mean, it's been easy for them to a certain extent to blame the international authority because that's been so overpowering in Bosnia in the last few years. And it's also been fairly easy for them to involve or devolve or descend into different constitutional squabbles and refight some of the issues of the war. And there's a void responsibility for an economy and a social situation that is fairly desperate. I think Laura Silber alluded to that.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Silber, what do you think about that? What do you consider to be the successes of Dayton?
Well, I agree with Carl Bildt completely in that I think the success was obviously in ending the war. And I am very worried about the fact of the real absence of a development of any kind of real democratic political culture among the politicians. And I think it was kind of a paradox in that there was a very strong international presence which was needed, a very robust presence that had wide-ranging powers, and that was needed because otherwise there was no way to knock together the heads of all these rival sides so that they could actually get about the business of passing laws and do all that. At the same time, it somehow, I think, stunted the growth of the Bosnian politicians. And so, and as much as the Bosnian politicians like to blame the outside world and the international administrators for the failures of Bosnia, it's also their fault because they really have refused and even impeded progress by their rivalry, by their petty political struggles that they're waging now. They're not fighting, but they're really waging them in the parliament. So that I think we have a lot of the issues still unresolved and a lot of the problems that could ostensibly really be addressed by a responsible political leadership, regardless of, say, party affiliation, that we really haven't seen yet. And I hope that as Bosnia moves in the future, in the very near future, obviously, into a much more European context, that somehow the politicians in Bosnia can see what's at stake and say, we need to address these and we really need to live up to the task at hand. And they haven't been able to do that so far.
Let's get another caller on the line and we'll go to Peter. Peter calling us from Corvallis, Oregon.
Hi there. My question regards Balkanization. You're talking about these groups of people with different backgrounds seemingly unable to rectify their differences. And, you know, that seems to be happening in lots of places, and people use the term Balkanization. I'm wondering what lessons we can take from this conflict in preventing these different groups of people becoming more and more disparate in their interest in just scrabbling for power and then resorting to this horrible violence. And I'm thinking in particular in Iraq, obviously we have similar sorts of problems, but I also feel like within the United States, our differences are becoming more and more acute, and it just really hurts to feel that direction.
Carl Bildt, I wonder if you thought about that.
Well, I haven't really thought about it in terms of the United States, but I've thought about it in relation to a lot of other issues that were mentioned. It is true. I mean, we have in what I sometimes refer to in the post-Ottoman space, the entire area that was once occupied by the Ottoman Empire, We have a mosaic of different nationalities and people. And we've tried to get them together in more or less functioning states. It's worked sometimes and has failed in other cases. I mean, Yugoslavia is a spectacular failure. We've succeeded to a certain extent in Bosnia in keeping a state, which includes then the different groups that we mentioned previously.
Mm-hmm.
We have a big problem in Kosovo, where we did an intervention in 1999. We failed to get a peace agreement with Kosovo, by the way, and after that failure there was a military intervention. And we tried to build a multi-ethnic society. We have utterly failed in that. We are now trying to set up an independent state. That might be the least bad of the bad solutions available, but I mean, we should recognize that that is a failure in that respect. We've had great difficulties getting Cyprus together. We have immense difficulties now, as we know, in Iraq, trying to get sort of the Kurds and the Arabs primarily to be together. I think the main lesson is that prevent these wars before they start. I mean, the irony, the tragic irony of the Bosnian situation is that we had really an agreement in, I think it was February or March of 1992, that is prior to the outbreak of the Bosnian War. There was an agreement that was signed, initially at least, on the future of Bosnia, which was in principle very much like Dayton.
Mm-hmm.
But there was not the willingness to go down that particular road at that particular time. And then instead we got more than 3 years of war, 100,000 dead, a million people displaced, because we did not have a sufficiently forceful and far-sighted diplomacy to prevent the war from happening. And once a war has started, it is very difficult to repair such a nation.
Carl Bildt, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Carl Bildt, former Prime Minister of Sweden, the European Union co-chair at the Dayton Peace Conference, and he joined us from Stockholm, Sweden. And Laura Silber, thank you so much for your time today as well.
Thank you.
Laura Silber covered the Balkan Wars for the Financial Times and is co-author of the book Yugoslavia, Death of a Nation. Joining us now is Richard Holbrooke. Richard Holbrooke was the chief negotiator for the 1995 Dayton Peace Accords in Bosnia, and he joins us now on the line from here in Washington, D.C. And Ambassador Holbrooke, very good of you to join us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Looking back on the 10 years of since Dayton, what are the lessons you think we should draw from this?
Well, the biggest lesson for me is that the United States has a role to play in these issues. It should take the lead, and when it engages, it makes a difference. We got into the Bosnian situation much too slowly. 1991, the Bush administration disengaged. Clinton, after campaigning that he would get involved, was slow to get involved. When we finally got involved in August of 95 in a serious way with an all-out negotiating effort and bombing, and by the way, I should note that three of my four initial negotiating team members were killed trying to get into Sarajevo, Bob Frazier, Joe Kruzel, and Nelson Drew, on that terrible road that Carl Bildt knows so well. When we finally got involved, including NATO bombing, we got them to the table, got them to the Wright-Patterson Air Base outside Dayton, Ohio, and forged the Dayton Peace Agreement. That was American leadership. The second point I'd make is that Dayton worked. It achieved all our initial objectives. It ended the war, and not one American or NATO soldier has been killed or wounded in the 10 years since then. 60,000 NATO troops went in, of which 20,000 were American. Now we're down to about 7,000 total, of which under 200 are American, and I repeat, no American or NATO killed or wounded. We wrote a peace agreement, unlike Iraq, which was full and complete. Everyone signed on to it, and the agreement worked. Now, Dayton wasn't perfect, but it achieved our objectives, and I think it stands as perhaps the most successful peace negotiation of the last quarter century anywhere in the world.
Ambassador Holbrooke, what do you think, then, are the challenges that lie ahead for the country?
For Bosnia?
Yes.
Well, the Dayton Agreement had plenty of flaws in it. Some of them are now being corrected. We allowed three armies to remain. You can't have three armies in a single country. And that was because NATO refused the mission of integrating them. But now they have military integration that has finally been agreed to. There were two ethnically based police forces. That was no good. That's being reformed. And today in Washington, Secretary of State Rice and Undersecretary of State Burns are heavily working on trying to fix some of the constitutional problems. This should have been done years ago, but quite frankly, in the 4 years leading up to the last few weeks, The U.S. government did absolutely nothing in the region of any consequence, and I'm including Kosovo in this because I heard your last discussion with Carl Bildt on Kosovo.
Mm-hmm.
Kosovo is going to be a much harder problem. Condoleezza Rice assigned the Undersecretary of State, Nick Burns, to this issue. Burns, who was a veteran of Dayton, 10 years ago today, he was at my side as we negotiated the final drama there. Exactly 10 years ago, almost to the hour, we pulled a negotiation out of a failure, a success out of a failure. Burns knows the area. He's engaged. And so they're trying to fix Dayton. It's belated, but it's the right thing to do. I want to echo something that I heard Carl Bildt say a minute ago. In Dayton, in Bosnia's case, we're trying to improve on a success to fix some of the flaws. But in Kosovo, we're going to have to deal with a situation that was ignored for the last 4.5 years and that has gotten progressively more tense and for which the solutions are going to be far, far more difficult.
We're talking about the lessons of the Dayton Peace Accords, which were signed 10 years ago today, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Katharina. Katharina's calling us from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'd like to know, of those people who fled, especially in those last days before the war began in 92, how many actually came back to Bosnia, particularly in Sarajevo? I wondered if you know that.
I'm so glad you asked that question. The statistics on the war are pretty staggering. 300,000 killed, 2.5 million homeless. Of the 2.5 million refugees homeless, well over half have now returned to the country. And most amazingly of all, many of them, many of them, statistics are a little weak here, have returned to minority areas. Let's take the worst place in the whole region, Srebrenica, the famous killing field where one of the great war crimes in the 20th century took place, where the Bosnian Serbs killed 7,700 Muslim men and young men in the soccer field. I was there in that soccer field, in that mud field, on its 10th anniversary a few months ago as a member of an official delegation. And to my utter amazement, 4,000 Muslims had returned to the valley. When I was there 5 years ago, the number was 10 Muslim families. Now 4,000 had returned. The Serbs who had come there from Sarajevo had begun to leave. They were down from 12,000 to 8,000. And I believe that when we come back there in 5 years, the valley will once again be a Muslim valley. That doesn't bring back the dead, and it doesn't bring justice to the people who lost their loved ones. But this is an amazing turn of events. The people want peace. It is their thuggish leaders, many of whom are just plain old mafioso crooks masquerading as nationalists, who prevent it. But the return of minorities, even to the most difficult areas, Banja Luka, Srebrenica, Foča, is well underway. As for your question about Sarajevo, do not forget that it was the Bosnian Serbs themselves, who drove their own people out of Sarajevo after Dayton. We had agreed they would stay. And the thugs who ran the separatist effort of the Serbs went in there, told Serb families who had lived there for generations, centuries, to burn their furniture, light up the gas ovens, explode their apartments, and leave. That was a terrible day, and I regret to say a day in which our own implementing forces, the NATO forces, stood by and did nothing. March 15th, 1996, a day I really think was the worst day of the last 10 years. But even there, the Serbs are coming back now. Progress is slow, slower than I want, but by God, it's happening.
Katharina, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
And Ambassador Holbrooke, we know you're extremely busy today on this 10th anniversary. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
It's my pleasure.
Richard Holbrooke, a former chief negotiator at the 1995 Dayton Peace Accords on Bosnia and former ambassador to the United Nations. He joined us by phone from here in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a short break. When we return, the puzzle master of Weekend Edition Sunday and the puzzle editor of the New York Times, Will Shorts, will join us. If you've always wanted to challenge the puzzle master, send him a puzzle. The address, TOTN at NPR.org. That's TOTN at NPR.org. If you've ever suffered at his hands trying to solve those devilish puzzles on Weekend Edition Sunday, you can just put payback in the subject line. Again, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.